Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Speaking to you from a very dry California here. So dry, in fact, that, as you know, many farmers in the Central Valley have had their irrigation cut off completely. That's true in Oregon and parts of Idaho as well. Even here in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, many water districts have cut their allocations to 40 to 60%, depending on where you are, which means 2 to 3 days out of the week, those pumps aren't running and those canals are dry. So if you depend on a municipal water supply or on some irrigation district to keep your garden or your homestead or your farm operating, it's time to radically rethink that approach right now. It's time to think pretty critically about water as a resource, how to harvest it, how to store it, how to use it best, how to reuse it, right? We'll talk about gray water systems. We'll talk about improving your soil's organic matter so that you can maximize infiltration of water during rain and storage of it and making it available to crops. We'll talk about varieties of plants that can produce a maximum of biomass given even a tight water budget. And we'll talk about some different methods of storing water in the land itself, from at-scale earthworks like swales and contour lines, all the way down to smaller things like drip irrigation and the clay pots, right, from antiquity. And then even as a bonus, we'll talk about just accepting that you might have an 8 or 9 month dry season. Well, how do you look at dry farming techniques to produce great yields even given that, even without all of these artificial methods? Because that would seem to be a very efficient and effective way of doing it. I think this is one of the most important conversations that we can be having, especially as we see that water is being used as a throttle on global food production and even on your and my ability to feed our families going forward. So, let's have that conversation now. And a lot of this isn't just academic. I've been here farming with a very long dry season for almost 5 years now, and working through a lot of these techniques, putting them to the test. So this isn't just some academic conversation we're having. I'll also be mixing in what has worked for me. It's a lot of mulch, a lot of the sunken pits instead of raised beds to minimize wind and evaporation to sun, right? You'll hear these same themes around protecting the water, protecting the life in your soil so that your plants can thrive. And that's because that's the name of the game. So thanks for joining me, and let's have that conversation. I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer broadcast. And if you live somewhere with lots of rain, maybe you get an afternoon shower every day, boy, that is ideal. And I might even be jealous of you, because that is just so perfect to have sunlight in the morning, a quick rain, and then more growing in the afternoon. You really don't even have to think about this. There are parts of the world where that's the case, and they just look at me like I'm crazy when I ask, you know, where's your drip irrigation? How are you doing these things? It's a different story than the one I've been enjoying here. Where that's not the case, or where you may experience some distance between some of those rains, then we need to start talking about how to store that water. It's called rainwater harvesting or water capture. You can see here a very basic and cost-effective example done on just some backyard, small shed, right? Not a huge installation of any sort, not an expensive thing, but it's perfectly effective at storing. It looks like about 100 gallons of water that would be collected off of that little shed there. And then you can use it for whatever animals you have, whatever plants are needing to be watered there. If you remember my video about the German Schrebergarten, almost every single person, they're just little allocations, I think they call them in the UK, small gardens that farmers will apportion off and then let people come in and work the land that don't have their own land. And almost every one of those Schrebergarten that we looked at had some aspect of water capture to then use there, because there's no plumbing, so that's just how they do it. Now you can scale that up to even a house size approach. It ceases to be nearly as cost effective at this point, right? I can imagine this would kind of a cistern at size, especially if you try and bury it, would start to be really expensive. Plus, when you look at even how much water you could store in this versus the other approach, storing water in soil, it's a totally different ballgame. But before we get there, I'll just say that, you know, this is perfectly acceptable. I don't know why you would put a warning label on your water. But there are, I know folks who've put in large tanks like this, or even just plumbed a series of IBC tanks such that it fills up all of them at the same time, and then they have effectively this large water battery that they can use during the weeks where they don't get rain. Now again, if you've got an 8-month dry season, this is helpful, but it's really not going to get you all the way through. It'll buy you a few weeks depending on how much you're irrigating, but then you're back to where you began. So this is just one. We're going to chip away at this problem with all these techniques that I sort of outlined at the top here, and gradually we'll start to make a real dent here. There are calculators like this one. There's a bunch of them on the web that are pretty helpful. They can be insightful for you to get an idea of, is it worthwhile, right? If I put in a giant cistern or a 55-gallon barrel or anything in between, how quickly is that going to fill up, right? So if we look at this, if I've got a, you know, just a 10x12 shed that has a surface on it, and I want to capture the water from it, and we only get 1 inch of rain, that already gives me almost 75 gallons. So it'll fill up that 55-gallon barrel in 1 inch of rain, just a tiny little bit of rain from a small shed gives you more than enough to fill that barrel. And if you start talking about a real structure, you know, 100 by 120 feet, then now you're looking at 7,000 gallons plus of water in just 1 inch of a rain. So you see that even a small house, that's why that shed is so productive. That's why it's worthwhile even to do it at that scale, because it doesn't take that much rain given a decent amount of surface area to add up pretty quickly. So if you have a house that has gutters and some of them are on one side, but you've got a couple of them that drain into one, you can go into Google Earth even and add up the area. You know, just draw a polygon, look at the area in square foot of that section of roof that drains to your, you know, the largest part of your roof that drains to a single downspout, and then try this out. Give it an inch of rain, see how many gallons of water you'd be able to collect given that inch of rain. And if you have more than an inch of rain in a given storm, you can do the math and see, get a picture of how effective that bit of roof would be at capturing water. So that's pretty cool. There are some considerations that I will fly through here. Like I said, I consider this whole conversation today a lightning talk, meaning we're not going to go in depth into any one of these aspects around water. I'm hoping that just by sort of having a conversation about some of these approaches, that it gives you some of the keywords and vocabulary and concepts and people and places that it's been tried, so that you can then use that as a vector in to do the deep dive, to go find out more about this. But it is worth mentioning here, I think, that if you're gonna collect water off of a surface, particularly a surface like a roof, then, and especially after a long dry season, there's a lot of gunk and pollen and dust and nonsense up there that you don't want to collect. And so you can build or buy what are called first flush diverters that will let some of those first few inches of water roll off with all the dirt, and then once that's done, it'll start collecting it. You can also just do it yourself, right? So when it rains for the first time, you let it go for a bit, and then you go move the pipe over to your water battery, to your storage, and start collecting the water once it's kind of rinsed off the surface from which you're collecting. But I wanted to mention first flush diverters, something you at least want to be aware of when you start collecting water. Okay, so now we have it raining. Now we're collecting some of that rain so that we can extend that water, we can pull that into our dry season. But there's another whole aspect of this, and that is that we are already, by virtue of the fact that we exist and take showers and do dishes and laundry, we're already using a great deal of water. And it would be super awesome if we didn't have to, if we could make use of that water more than once, right? If we could take, and in the case of gray water, like those examples that I just named, laundry, dishes, even taking a shower, all of that water is perfectly fine to use in your garden, given some basic caveats that I'll mention in a second. We're not talking about, I think obviously, black water. Stuff that comes out of the toilet, still, we don't want that. That's going to go still into your septic or whatever. But if it's from those previous sources, and if you are using non-toxic laundry detergents, right, salt-free shampoos, If you're treating your body well when you're in the shower, then most of those things are fine to go into your garden to use to water your plants. And that's a great way, again, of extending the water we already have before we even start talking about all these other approaches. Gray water systems are often colored purple. That's just the canonical standard color for piping. So if you see a system like this with purple tubes running throughout someone's garden, it's a pretty good indicator that that's gray water, and you probably don't want to drink it, but it's perfectly cool for the garden. One of the coolest and most inspired examples of a gray water system that I've seen is those that are encoded into those initial designs of the Earth ships. And I did a video about this years ago, but we have hundreds of thousands of more people these days. So the way that the Earth ship makes multiple uses of its water is somewhat like this. They do harvest water from their roof and collect it into a cistern. That is first use. There's a first use, which is the clean water, right? Potable water, and then you use it for cleaning and bathing and washing your dishes. That's the gray water. And in that case, they pipe that into, you can see Earth ships typically have this sort of a mini greenhouse in the front here with a bed for growing. That's the second use of water. So you're going to use your clean water here, and then it's going to go into those interior beds for using for water. That all drains down into water that can then be used for bottom of the barrel uses, quite literally, like flushing your toilet. And then at that point, finally, that's black water. Then we can let it go into the septic or wherever else it's going. And in fact, they usually make a point of using some biomass-producing trees over the septic tank to even eke a final use out of that water. And that's because a lot of these designs came from parts of New Mexico or Arizona where they just don't have a lot of water to work with. And so getting four uses out of 1 gallon of water means you don't need the other 3 gallons that a typical Western wasteful house is using. Okay, so gray water systems, something really cool to think about. Again, you want to make sure that you're not using toxic shampoos or soaps or detergents. You shouldn't be anyway, but it may just have to put that in there as a safety mentioning. And then one other consideration is that if you're pulling up very hard water, if you have hard water full of minerals where you are, and you have a water softener on your house, that's using salt to keep those minerals from getting hard on your interior appliances. So anything that's been run through a water softener, you don't want to use, and you cannot use in a gray water system. It would kill off your plants. Even hard water in the first place is going to have a lot of mineral buildup that will eventually get your plants to the point where there's nutrient lockout and they can't even absorb, even if they're in the best soil, they've got so much salt buildup that you can't, they won't be able to uptake nutrients. So if you have a water softener, it's off, game over for gray water, at least until you stop using that softener. You can imagine there may be a point in the future where if all other water supplies stop, if they turn off your municipal water, then maybe you stop using salt in your water softener and you switch over to a gray water system. It's important to have options available so that as exterior conditions change, you can adjust your own practices. Okay, anything else on gray water? Yes, one thing on gray water that is sort of a common conception, perhaps misconception, is that this belief that universally gray water is very alkaline. One way, in fact, Jeff Lawton mentions that the way he typically will do it is to plumb the gray water into a compost bin that needs water, because that's a typically acidic process anyway, and so that kind of neutralizes part of that. So here from thegraywaterguide.com, the common misconception is that all gray water is alkaline and that acid-loving plants wouldn't do well with it, right? You wouldn't put strawberries on a gray water drip line. But continuing, quote, the pH of your shower water really depends on what you put in it. It depends on your shampoo. So if you look into that, if you are, again, this is when you start really trying to eke out as much as you can from each drip of water, then you start thinking holistically about the way you're using it. What kind of shampoo? What's the pH of my soap, right? Because all of that's going to inform the downstream uses of it. Typical bar soap has a pH of 7, so shouldn't be a big deal. And then washing machines are really, even in systems where People don't want to go to the trouble of doing a whole house gray water system. Or as I mentioned, if you have a water softener, and so you can't take that salty water out into a gray water, some people will redo the plumbing to their washing machine so that it's not part of that softened water. So that's unprocessed water, and that means that they can then take it out of the washing machine and pipe that into the garden. So there's a few different ways of working with that I wanted to mention. All right, so now we have water. One other aspect, actually, just since we're talking about wastewater here, is that urine is perfectly fine to use in your garden. That's not part of the black water at all. Now, if you're eating a very salty diet, you wouldn't want to put that salt on your plants. If you're taking antibiotics, you wouldn't want to eliminate any of that onto your garden, right? Again, you have to think more holistically about all your things you're putting into your water, all the things you're putting into your body, because when we're closing the loop, when we're tying our whole system together, all these things are going to affect each other. But short of that, if you're living a pretty healthy lifestyle and you're not on pharmaceuticals, then there's nothing wrong with using urine in your garden. You're going to water it down a little bit. It's got lots of nitrogen in the form of urea. And if it's not that salty, there's no reason that you can't use that on your garden. Okay, so now we have rain. We've stored some of it away so that we can extend our water into the dry season. We're using our water more times than we were before, so we can pull it even further forward. Now let's talk about how to keep the water in the soil. What we're seeing here is an example of sunken beds. This is one thing that I have done a lot of. When I first got here, I built some raised beds. They dried out very quickly. I built some straw bale beds. They lost water even more quickly because they're pretty porous. But my sunken beds stay wet. And so I dig down into the ground. You can see here, these are also called waffle gardens for obvious reasons. You dig down into the ground and then fill that with very organic matter rich soil. As we'll talk about in a second, that helps to hold more moisture. It's capable of holding more moisture in anyway. And then by virtue of the fact that it's away from the sunlight, it's away from the air and the wind, it has a reduced evaporation. Right? So you can see we're designing places for this soil and moisture to sit that will keep these things there, that will make the use of the water that we're now applying into our soil. Here's another example of sunken beds and waffle gardens. The another example that if you're in permaculture circles at all, you've probably heard is the banana circle, the banana pit, where you dig a pit pretty deep and then you fill it, again, you fill it with organic matter, tons of compost, and then put a ton of mulch around it, and then you plant all around it. And these plants, in this case, banana trees, along the periphery of the circle will sense that there's a ton of moisture, there's a water battery sitting right next to them in this organic matter, and their root systems will grow around and to accommodate that and pull the moisture out. So this is one way of pushing water down into the ground, covering it up with mulch so it stays there, and then making sure that it's available to the banana trees. When you take that concept and then blow it out to gardens, to sunken beds as a whole, I've had a lot of success with that. So this is one example from a guy on permies.com that I modeled some of my garden after, where he dug deep these mulch trenches just to put into the ground this organic matter to hold on to water. And then he's placed sunken beds sort of all around these things that the plants that he's planting, the crops, will grow their roots down into this big storage of water. And that makes for one happy farmer, even though he doesn't have rain 8 months out of the year. It's pretty daunting at first, but again, by combining all these techniques and thinking holistically about it and having some patience and doing some experiments, you can get there. Now, as I intimated earlier, water barrels, you got to pay for them, and they can only store 50 gallons, or if you pay a lot for a big cistern, a few thousand. But it's only scratching the surface compared to how much water you can put into your soil. And so when we look at some of the doing this at scale, right, having enough time and resources to look at the lay of the land, literally find the parts of your site that are on level with each other. That's called contour lines. It looks exactly like what you see these lines on a topographical map. And what that allows you to do is sort of build things on contour. In other words, create those mulch trenches we were just seeing so that they're level. Because you've probably heard the word swales, which are just these trenches that are designed to sink the water down into the soil and store them there. It's like a mulch pit, but extended out horizontally. There's a couple ways to build those. One of them is on contour, like this here, where wherever those contour lines on your hill are, you'll dig down and build a trench there, a swale there, that will infiltrate the water and then keep it there for all the crops you're trying to build. Now, there are also swales that are off contour that are meant to take water and move it back and forth across the site. You can do a ton of amazing things with water, and I'm not going to go too much further into earthworks here because they're kind of time and money expensive, time and capital expensive, especially if you start talking about renting machines to get that done. But definitely look further into that. Now, there's other things you can do, like building fruit walls. Now, this is another thing that we've talked about before in the context of helping crops and fruit trees grow even when it gets cold. In fact, as we read here, the fruit walls really began to appear around the start of the Little Ice Age, a period of exceptional cold in Europe, beginning around 1550. And so they would build these walls that just were there to hold some of the solar energy from the sun in, to keep the wind from blowing it all around, and just sort of provide some insulation. But the same, which will continue to work, it will also be effective at keeping the wind from blowing all of your moisture out, at providing some shade for some of your crops. So in fact, if you're in a place that has really hot, dry summers, but also brutally cold winters, then offering this kind of sort of insulation, these kinds of little cells to help out. It's like this is what they did before greenhouses. Can be a good idea. Now, there's other ways to get shade that will help minimize evaporation. Some people just put up shade cloth. They just put up 50, 70% shade cloth. You will not get as much solar energy into your plants, but that's an acceptable trade-off if you're already in a place where they're struggling so much because of excessive heat that they're spending all of their energy transpiring the water, then they're not getting to grow anyway. So it may be a situation where you want to take that hit, less solar energy available to them, but less heat, so then they're actually able to make use of that solar energy to grow instead of just spending all of their energy trying to endure through the hot temperatures. It's a trade-off you'll have to experiment with and get some experience where you are. See what works for you. On a smaller scale, this is like a fruit wall, Sepp Holzer style, another permaculture practitioner who said you can offer shade and protection against wind, all the things we're describing, on a small scale just by putting some rocks around the things that you plant. And here's an example of that. This is a dry farming technique as well. This is a picture from the Hopi dry farmer Michael Kotutra, who uses this large rock here next to the melon plant to keep it moist, right? So that it doesn't dry out completely before it even gets a chance to come out of the ground. So let's talk some more about the soil. I mentioned that if you have more organic matter, your soil is better able to infiltrate water, which means less of the water is going to run off or pool. If you're completely flat, then if you have dead soil, your water it doesn't infiltrate very effectively, and you'll just get standing water and you'll flood out. I remember talking to Gabe Brown, who said when his neighbors were all flooded out, his property was able to infiltrate the water. It just absorbed it all down, and it was able to hold on to a ton of that because his soil has such a high coefficient of organic matter that it does great. And here from the NRCS is this statistic that was from a study citing that for every 1% increase in the organic matter in your soil, you're able to store an extra 25,000 gallons of water per acre. That's why I sort of shrug my shoulders at the huge, expensive cisterns and say, okay, it's a better use of my time to improve my soil because I can store tens of thousands of gallons of water there and grow food, right? And get a yield instead of just dump money into the ground and then have to deal with pumping water out of it or something like that. So this is a better answer to me. Although, again, you can combine all of these things. If we can take our water from the rain, bring it further into the wet season by virtue of harvesting and storing in a cistern, put it into the soil through some of these systems, recycle it with the gray water, you see we're actually starting to make some impact here. We're starting to make a difference. It's not just the infiltration, like I said, it's actually just holding on to that soil. Organic matter acts like a sponge for water retention. It also is able to release it back to the plants when they ask for it. So a lot of these presentations have to do with climate change and global warming, and we'll just ignore that for now. This is yet another one of the reasons about water that I harp so much on these five principles of soil health, soil husbandry. Because when you treat your soil right, you're going to naturally have better plants. Those principles, as I always go over them, we'll do it again, are minimize disturbance to the soil. Don't go and till it every season. You kill all the life off. It's really counterproductive. Always keep a living root in the soil at all times. It means cover crops in the off season. It means keeping your soil covered at all times. We talk about having armor on there. I've been saying mulch the heck out of your beds, sunken or raised, whatever they are, wherever it is. Make sure that there's no evaporation of the moisture from the soil happening, because that's your water. That's the precious water we're trying to keep here. Not to mention, it's just better for the life of your soil if you keep the sun from hitting the soil directly. It'll heat it up and kill off a lot of your microbiome. Maximize biodiversity. They say it here as species diversity of vegetation. Just keeping tons of different crops. Monocropping doesn't scale. It doesn't work. It's not healthy. It's very disease susceptible. And then incorporating animal. Absolutely. Incorporate animals whenever possible. It's a vital part of our nutrient loop. Okay, the reason I go over these soil principles again is because when you follow them, you get and you protect all of that microbiome in your soil, and that means more organic matter, and that means more storage of water. And that's the goal of this conversation. How do we make the most of it? How do we keep it in there? There's a concept called lasagna gardening that I think was popularized by Ruth Stout, and she gives a her reasoning was that she's lazy and she didn't want to till and dig and stuff, so she just kept throwing stuff on her gardens. That's great. I am doing something quite similar because, like I said, I just mulch the heck out of everything. I don't want there to be any chance that moisture is escaping from my beds. So I'll throw on compost, and then I'll throw on some leaves from the oak trees, and then I'll throw on some grass, and then I'll throw on some extra straw or whatever. Just keep throwing stuff on because it's always turning into more soil, which is bonus anyway. But again, we're keeping that armor on there at all times. And it's one of the things when I'm walking around my garden that I'm looking for. Are there any holes in my mulch where moisture could be getting out? Because that's not allowed. I got a real strict water budget that I have to adhere to here. Hugo culture is another word we should throw in here. And you may have heard of this. It's basically taking a log and burying it in one of these sunken beds as you're preparing it, filling it up, and then planting into it. And the idea here is, like we've been reading about organic matter or decomposing logs, in this case, it acts like a sponge. So in the wet season, these logs here, as they're decomposing, are going to soak up a bunch of water. And then throughout the dry season, it's just available to whatever's growing here. As it decomposes, more and more of that water is released as your roots grow down into them. They don't just have that water, they have the decomposing, the nutrients from this log that's decomposing. So you get sort of a twofer there. I do not do hugo culture. In fact, I don't even do swales. When I first got here years ago, I was pretty psyched. I had just done my first permaculture design course, and I thought, I'm going to do hugels and I'm going to do swales, and they just laughed at me. Luckily, I talked to other permaculturalists here, and so should you. Find out more about your local environment before you try any technique, because somebody's tried it and they can tell you whether it works or not. and I heard unambiguously and unanimously that it just wasn't worth doing swales or hoogles because there's no rain. And if there was rain, even if there were just a little bit of rain every 3 months, then that would push water back into these swales and back into these decomposing logs, and it would work. Everything I just described would work as advertised. But given a true California-style 8-month dry season, it's just not, the return is not there. You go to all this effort, and then even the logs will dry out. I did try a few of them, and sure enough, midway through the dry season, you dig down into it, you just find dry logs. It's not decomposing, it's turning into dust. That's sort of what happens here without that rain. So I don't do these things, but I know they work well in other places. Okay, so stepping back. We've got some water. We harvested it from our surfaces. We stored it into our water batteries. We used it and we made reuse of it. So we're pulling water further into our dry season, and we're stretching it as far as we can, and we're making sure it doesn't get out of our soil by sinking it down in. We're following those basic permaculture water principles of spread it, slow it, spread it, and sink it. Spread out the water instead of letting it concentrate and then run off. Sink it down into the soil so it can be held onto. And slow it down. Now what do we do with it? Now we've got this water. How do we get it into the plants, to the root systems where it's needed? Well, it's only fair to mention this age-old technique, this ancient technique of clay pots in the soil, the ollas, where you just bury a little clay pot, a little terracotta thing, and you fill it up with water. And as the soil dries out, the water wicks out from the terracotta into the soil. You can see, you can do it in raised beds, you can bury it, like we just saw in the previous image. And that's the whole name of the game. The water that's in this buried terracotta thing, this clay pot, even if it's totally dry on top, will stay in there and will slowly seep out to the plant, which generally, just like the banana circles, will wrap its root system around the clay pot. It's like, oh, there's water over here, and it goes and wraps its roots around this clay pot and sucks the water out of it. And then you just walk around from time to time and fill up your clay pots with water. Or you do sort of a hybrid system where you've got clay pots and you've got drip line going to it. Or you do this is a sort of example of siphoning off the water into the clay pot from a bigger reservoir. And importantly, one that's visible to you. So you only have to walk outside and notice that it's low, because you don't want to have, you know, you don't want to walk around and look inside each little pot. We're trying to minimize our labor too, and any chance for a mistake here. So if it's a highly visible reservoir like this, that then is siphoned off into any number of clay pots, at least that's just one thing that we have to worry about, and it's visible to us. It's a nice little design consideration there. We can also talk about drip irrigation, which is something I hate. Frankly, I can't stand this stuff because it's brittle and it breaks, and if you step on it wrong, you have to go, you know, deal with it. But I have laid plenty of 7-10 and quarter inch piping all over the place because it is much more efficient than a sprinkler, spraying it off into the air, a lot of that evaporating off from the sunshine before it even hits the ground. Again, with a tight water budget, I can't afford to have water running off into the atmosphere. So drip line lets me put the water right where I need it, right at the base of this root of this plant, and keep those things alive. It's a much more efficient, even if it's kind of annoying. I'm still looking for a brand or something like that of drip line that won't break, that will last forever. But for now, that's what we're dealing with. There are also ways to do subsurface drip lines, where you go in while you're running your irrigation, and you put these drip lines in before you then backfill it with soil. And that means that the water's never at the surface. There's never any opportunity for evaporation. A lot of people really like subsurface. I'm not using it because I haven't gone to all that trouble, and I still like to be able, especially given how brittle they are, like I just said, I need to be able to walk around and do a quick spot check. I want to be able to visually see that the water is still coming out, that these haven't been clogged up with dirt or bugs or whatever sediment coming from downstream. That's another thing that I find annoying is how high maintenance these drip lines are. You have to have little screen filters and check them once a week to make sure they're not getting clogged up so there's still enough pressure. You got to be really careful with how much pressure is going into the drip line and make sure that you have, you know, you never exceed the flow rate of your 710 by virtue of adding too many things. So you do a bunch of hydro zoning. These things are going to have so many gallons per day, and you know, it's you got to do a little bit of math, a little bit of homework to make sure that the right amount of water is getting to the right plants consistently. But again, compared to running a big sprinkler or a big irrigation pivot, right? This is a orders of magnitude more effective way to use that precious water that they're turning off. You can also combine this with some of those wicking approaches. And I've mentioned in the past, I showed you the aquaponics wicking bed that I made based on Rob Bob, great channel, Rob Bob's Aquaponics. And he has these designs, has tested all sorts of permutations of different wicking beds, how to run aquaponic water through these beds that that just pull it up into them. And so you never have to water them because as they dry out, they will organically, they're naturally going to suck up a little bit more water, but just what they need. So you can actually combine that with the drip irrigation system just by sort of floating. You can really imagine, I'm including this because I want you to start thinking creatively about what you're doing here. So if you've got an aquaponic system sitting in your backyard and then a garden over here, we don't have to, and I have to water this every day. Well, maybe not. Maybe we actually just run that return line from your aquaponics close to the garden and then have some drip line that's able to wick into those beds. There's really creative, interesting ways to do this that are actually going to maximize your use of water. And if you're using aquaponic water, you're pulling in some nutrients too. There's a little bit of fertigation there. Check that out. At scale, you know, I mentioned the irrigation pivots. At scale, there are starting to be some people who are putting these two things together, like a hybrid pivot using drip irrigation. And I expect we're going to see more of this as this continues, right? As they continue to have water allocations at a fraction of what farmers have been used to. By necessity, they'll start looking into things that aren't spraying water off onto the highway and into the atmosphere, but are doing pretty strategic placement of water right into the crops where they're needed. Okay, so we're storing water, we're pulling it further into the dry season, we're keeping it in our beds, we're holding it in our soil, we're delivering it right to the plants where it's needed. What kind of plants can make the best use of water? How do we maximize our yields given a slim water budget? I've done a lot of experiments and a lot of reading, and I can't remember where I read it. I think it was a Sepp Holter. I can't remember where I came across it. It was a fantastic chart of yields in terms of biomass per water, and sorghum was head and shoulders above everything else. And so I got a bunch of sorghum and planted it. And another cool thing about sorghum is just how prolific it is. You get tons of seeds off of each head, and so that's never going to be a problem for you. You grow sorghum one season, you've got it, as long as you eke it out. So why am I even mentioning sorghum? A lot of studies, including this one, are mentioning that it produces a tremendous amount of biomass. It looks a lot like corn, right? You get the initial just a ton of stalks and leaves, and then the grain heads that you can feed to chickens as well. It's got a ton of uses on my homestead here, is another reason I grow it. But particularly in lieu of the water situation. And this study shows that even when we deprive the sorghum crop of half of the water that we typically give it, so right here, quote, at 50% of its irrigation, some sorghum still produces 10 tons of biomass per acre growing up to 10 feet tall, even when you give it half of the water it's supposed to get. And the study itself concludes, quote, this is the best fit for producers with limited irrigation situations, which is almost all of us now, right? Even the dry land with the 5 inches of moisture, so even more strict watering, still produces 2 to 3 tons of biomass per acre. So that's why sorghum is by far at the top of the list in as far as how do we create a ton of biomass. Because remember, I've got to feed my chickens. I've got to have a ton of mulch. I keep saying that word. Where are we going to get all that mulch? I need something to grow for the mulch. I need something sweet, right? I need some sorghum syrup. It takes a lot of effort to grind that stuff out and boil it down. But sorghum has a lot of uses, and that's one of the reasons why, and it grows well here. That's one of the reasons why I've done this, is plant a lot of sorghum. Beyond sorghum, you're going to be looking for drought-tolerant varieties of anything, right? And so I'm not going to go through each one here, but I've got a series of this table from this book, Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land. Again, it's motivated by global warming in their minds, but it's still interesting data that we can put to use here, giving you names of varieties of amaranths and artichokes. Cowpea does really well in the heat and without a lot of water. But even more traditional annuals, eggplants, lima beans. I'll be putting up a link to these, or you can just pause the video and take a look as I scroll through here. Some of these are also very heat tolerant, and what you'll be looking for if you're in a colder zone is something that is both drought tolerant but also relatively hardy, which is not impossible to find. In fact, the several varieties that I wanted to mention here as we scroll through here, the figs that I like the most are the Chicago hardy figs. They are as drought tolerant as any other fig tree, right? It's a Mediterranean kind of a plant. But the Chicago hardy is also able to tolerate temperatures even below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's an awesome tree as we enter the grand solar minimum. I like the persimmons that are Mount Fuji sons. They can also go below 0 degrees and are also drought tolerant, right? You can see sort of the combination of attributes that we're looking for here. What's going to make extraordinarily resilient food production is something that can tolerate the heat, something that can tolerate the cold, and something that can tolerate the drought. Basically, when we talk about the symptoms of the grand solar minimum, and we say it's precipitative extremes, but on both sides, it's temperature extremes on both sides, those, we need plants that are able to deal with these kinds of extremes. The Russian red pomegranate is another one that I'm a fan of that's producing well for me, both cold and heat tolerant. And then, you know, mulberries, carobs, loquats, a lot of Mediterranean style trees will do well in drought tolerant. And when I say they're drought tolerant, what I mean is if you can get them through that first season, if you can, you know, give them a drip line for a season or two while they establish, then you're done. Then you have invested that effort up front in getting those trees to establish where you are. You can pull out your drip line and they're good to go through that long dry season because they already have their roots down deep enough that they can pull water up from where it's somewhere down below in the nethers of your soil. And even beyond the varieties that I just enumerated and that were listed in that table, it's worth mentioning, and I mention this all the time, seeds learn. Plants learn. If you go get some seeds, especially from your neighbor, where they've already been grown in your neighborhood, but even if you buy them online and they come from, you know, Missouri, where they've got plenty of water, and then you get them through one season where you are, they're already adapted better to where you are. And so if you take a couple varieties of corn and you don't give them quite as much water as they want, right? Maybe they're looking a little bit sad, but you're all right with that because you know that if you can eke out a crop from this corn with half as much water as it's expecting, then next year, the seeds that you get from this corn are going to only expect half of that water, and they'll do much better next year, even on that same amount of water, right? So you are acclimating your own varieties. You're creating your own land races of whatever grows well already for you, and things will just continue to get better and better. The whole idea here is that we are investing effort into these systems, whether we're talking about swales or your own varieties or establishing a food forest with drought-tolerant trees that need a little bit of effort to plant and then irrigate them for a season, but then you're done. Then you pull out the drip line and you just get food for the rest of time, longer than I'll be alive, these trees will be giving my family fruit. And that's awesome to me. In all of these cases, we're putting in some initial investment because we know that the goal is to get to that perennial payoff, these perennial polycultures that just keep giving us free food, even though we have stopped giving them effort. That's the goal. Let's get to the easy life here. All right, and I wanted to close with a reference to Hopi dry farming. One of the first interviews I did on this channel was with a gentleman named Michael Kotutra, who is a Hopi dry farmer who talked all about how they are able to grow abundant food. He feeds himself and his family without any irrigation and with an 8-month dry season, right? So they get the monsoon and that seeps down into the earth. And by using both, you know, incredibly robust Hopi genetics that they've refined over hundreds of generations, and then some basic dry farming techniques, doesn't need water, doesn't need irrigation. The plants are able to take care of that on their own. Now he's created, this is a talk unto itself, and he's created a series of slides that I've made available on iceagefarmer.com. I'll put a link to that as well below. But just as a quick look into that, some of the ways that you get that approach to work are by planting very far apart, because these plants are going to grow extensive root systems that are going to seek and find that water. So you can't plant them too close, or they're competing for the same water resources. And then by planting them really deep, and I mean, here's an example, corn planted at 18 inches deep, it all depends on how much water is in the soil when you're in the planting season. Beans at 4 inches deep, squash and melons 4 inches deep. So this is much deeper than normal, right? But that's because he wants them to already be down there building that root system way deeper to go and find that water. And so by the time they actually are starting to sprout, they're already starting to reach the water table down there beneath. And again, it's, you can't do this with just, you know, bantam sweet corn from Missouri. It's not gonna work the same as these really heirloom genetics from a Hopi dry farmer. But again, like we just said with the land races, you can start moving that way. You can take a couple different varieties of corn and make your own hybrid and put it through a series of years getting deeper and drier and start to move the needle in that direction. And over time, as your plants adapt, you will need to water them less and less. So that is less of an immediate payoff, but it's something that we need to be bearing in mind at all times, is that our plants, just like we are learning and adapting. And if we embrace that and help them to learn and adapt to the conditions we want them, that we need them to, then everyone's going to be happier. So that's why I wanted to close that. And just look at this, that what he produces there with no rain and no irrigation is amazing and beautiful and inspiring. And we can do this too. We can all do this. We don't need city water and government handouts to feed our families, no matter where you are. So like I said, this has been a lightning talk. I threw as much in here as I could. I left out a bunch. I'm sure I left out things I didn't even mean to. But I really do hope that this got you thinking in new ways and maybe introduced a new term or two to you that you can now go dig deeper into and have some conversations with people in your neighborhood. I'm going to give the same talk here in my community to people who've had their irrigation turned off and their gardens are dying, right? People are pretty upset right now. It's not a happy time for most folks around here. But when armed with this kind of a knowledge, then at least we know what we should be doing. At least we know how to respond to the state turning off the water. So go have those conversations with people in your neck of the woods, and thank you for joining me here today. I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer channel. You can find this talk, along with all of my reports about the state of food production and the attacks on humanity, at iceagefarmer.com. If you appreciate this broadcast and value the information, help me keep it running. There's a few ways to do that listed at iceagefarmer.com/support, and I very genuinely appreciate your help. Indeed, I couldn't do this without you, so thank you. Folks, thanks very much. Let's go store some water and grow some drought-tolerant crops and do it in the face of the technocrats who think that we won't be able to figure this out. Thanks for watching.